by sharing their stories. Members of our community perform readings of notable speeches and essays from inspiring figures past and present, a radically empowering opportunity to hear the echoes of history in the present day. Again, that's Voices of a People's History, a movement of movements, on Wednesday, July 10th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 10 o'clock. Coming up next, it's the Heather McCoy Show. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews author Ted Chiang about his new book of science fiction stories titled Exhalation. And at 11:30, Black Book talks to Lua Ubunifu, the author of Caged and Locked, My Personal Experience with Circumstantial Depression. Then from noon until 10 p.m., it's our live broadcast from the Waterfront Blues Festival. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to KBOO.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
Show.
And welcome to the Heather McCoy Show. Joining me for the entire hour is Chris Stroop. Chris is one of the leading voices in the ex-evangelical movement, a movement which is comprised of former evangelical Christians who are deconstructing from a fundamentalist Christian doctrine and challenging evangelicals in the public squares as they try to install a theocracy. Chris has started numerous hashtags on Twitter, including hashtag empty the pews, hashtag alt Christian facts, and most recently hashtag expose Christian schools after news broke that the second lady Karen Pence took a job at the Emanuel Christian School, which has a policy that discriminates against both LGBT people and those affirming the community. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi, Heather. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's really awesome to speak to you. So the ex-evangelical movement is dynamic in both in breadth and depth. Is there anything you would like me to add for listeners who have never heard of it before?
Sure. I guess I would say that we often use the hashtag ex-evangelical, you know, a portmanteau, well, more just sort of a contraction of ex-evangelical, the longer form, to connect on Twitter. And there is also a Facebook support group if anybody is interested in joining that, where we kind of can talk in a more private way about our issues, though it does have over 4,000 people in it, so it's, you know, not necessarily 100% private anymore, but it should, it's people who get it, and it's also moderated as a safe space using principles of intersectional feminism. So you know, occasionally a troll gets into the group, but they usually don't last very long.
There's also a Portland group. It's I think it's like X. I always forget the evangelical name, Beverly's. I think it's X Beverly's PDX or something like that. So there's
that's
an offshoot.
That's pretty funny. Yeah, because you know, that Beverly meme, if some people may remember, it's one of these viral memes that went around the internet. There was a real woman apparently named Beverly who posted to social media that her sister-in-law died in a fire, but miraculously her Bible was preserved, and isn't that just a miracle?
Yeah.
And so from that meme in the ex-evangelical Facebook support group, people started referring to evangelicals, both men and women, who fit this kind of mold of just like so tone deaf and clueless, as Beverly's.
Yeah. The ex-evangelical movement reminds me a little of the Riot Grrrl movement in the early 90s because of its confessional confrontation of violence, both physical and psychological, and using an ethnography to speak truth to power. Is that a correct evaluation of the ex-evangelical movement?
I can see that parallel, and I'm personally honored by that parallel because I really admire the old Riot Girl stuff.
Yeah. So just to give listeners a background on who you are and where you came from, how did you get into fundamentalist Christianity, and how did you start the process of deconstructing your fundamentalist beliefs?
You know, I was pretty much born into it because both my parents, they grew up with sort of somewhat more moderate religion in their lives. My dad's family, working class family, he grew up partly in Pennsylvania, but then in South Bend, Indiana, which is a little industrial city in northern Indiana that a lot of people who care about sports probably know about from Notre Dame football. So he went to a Lutheran church sometimes, but it just wasn't that big a deal in his life. And my mom grew up in rural central Indiana, and her family attended United Methodist, which is a mainline church, you know, but they also didn't necessarily go all the time. And when they got to college, they ended up both getting connected with the Christian Student Foundation and then living in the campus house that belonged to that organization. I guess they kind of had conversion experiences, and they wanted this more demanding sort of Protestantism, I suppose, to fill a kind of void that they were feeling in their lives and maybe to deal with the confusion post-60s and post-Vietnam. So, yeah, by the time I was born in 1980, they were attending a missionary church in the small town in northern Indiana where I was born, where I became infamous once I got old enough to walk for trying to escape from the nursery, sometimes successfully. you know, we had the church potlucks and all that sort of thing. Sang some of the classic Sunday school songs, including creepy ones like "I'm in the Lord's Army." I have vague memories of some of it.
So, is it a lot like Jesus Camp, the film, or was it a little
somewhat.
Somewhat, okay.
I was there until I was like 4 and a half. Then we moved to a north suburb of Indianapolis, Fishers specifically. I did kindergarten in a public school. Mom was herself a graduate of Ball State University with a master's degree in education. She has her life teacher's license in the state of Indiana. Dad also graduated from Ball State and got a teaching license. He was a high school band director before he became a music pastor. And I was in a public school for kindergarten because mom was staying home with my sister and me until we were both old enough to go to school. And then the next year she went to become a teacher at Heritage Christian School in Indianapolis, and we both went there. At that time, the tuition was free. Now it's a discount that increases with seniority. But yeah, so as soon as my sister was old enough to be in school, my parents sent us to Christian school. And I was just really... you know, that was my social world for the most part growing up. I wasn't as isolated as some people. I did get to do some extracurricular activities, particularly in high school, but even in some cases a little bit younger, outside that close little evangelical Christian world where you have this whole parallel culture and these parallel institutions. You've got the schools, the bookstores, the music industry, temporary Christian music. I did get to do like some community theater and some stuff, so I kind of had a window outside of it. And my grandma also, as a kid, gave me a subscription to Ranger Rick magazine, so I would read that because I had an interest in nature and animals. And I would tell myself, well, when they say that stuff about evolution, we know that's not true. But I also would like learn about environmentalism and endangered species and tell my parents, hey, we should start recycling, which they never did until everyone was doing it. But, you know, I tried.
I was just kind of curious, on the scale of like 1 to 10, like how isolated were you from like the secular world, where 10 would be if you're a member of FDLS out in the rural Utah, and 1 being that you have regular contact with secular people?
Yeah, I mean, 10 would also probably be, say, the Quiverful.
Yeah, the Quiverful movement too.
Right. So within evangelicalism, fundamentalism, I don't know. We were more like a five, I suppose.
Okay.
Or I mean, most of our social, I mean, it would depend on how exactly you would define the measure, but most of our social world absolutely was evangelical Christian, because our friends were from school, or in some cases from the neighborhood, but the friends that we played with the most were Christians, and the ones that weren't were kind of looked askance at. I even led one little boy from down the street to the Lord, which I'm so embarrassed about now. So yeah, mostly church and Christian school, those were our social connections. So everything else was kind of extraordinary, and I wouldn't say that I really broke out of that until high school, when I, after my sophomore year and my junior year, I was able to do summer honors programs at Indiana State University, where you take a class and you get college credit. So suddenly I met all these secular people. It was culture shock and weird. I did spend half of sixth grade in public school as well, because my family moved to Colorado Springs at that time. And then, though, after that school year was over, my mom was teaching at Colorado Springs Christian School, and I begged my parents to let me stay in the public school, but they forced me to go to the Christian school. Yeah. So I had like that little window in sixth grade, too.
And what I think people don't realize about Christian versus private school is we were talking before we went on the air briefly, and we're roughly the same age. And so I went to public school throughout my life, but because of the culture gravitas that evangelical Christianity had when I was a kid, basically it felt like a private religious school in a lot of ways. And so I remember being in 12th grade and like having bisexual feelings and just being, you know, the residue of that culture was all around us at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's still true that in many parts of America, public schools can also basically be bastions of evangelicalism. But at least if anyone really wants to make a big deal out of it legally, there could potentially be some pushback. Hopefully they're a little better in some things. But, you know, I mean, I've attended a public school graduation in a small town in Indiana where the graduation ceremony opened with prayer. So, you know. And there are plenty of stories of people getting creationist propaganda in science classes in public schools. So that is a problem.
Yeah.
Christian schools are kind of their own special sort of problem, because they're not regulated at all. They're not publicly accountable. I mean, not regulated at all. Well, some of them are accredited by certain bodies. Often it's their own accreditation bodies, like the Association of Christian Schools International. But that is considered to be accredited by, say, colleges. For example, I was able to get a college prep high school diploma from Heritage Christian School in Indianapolis after we moved back from Colorado Springs to the Indianapolis area. But I don't know that that necessarily should be the case. I mean, honestly, I think if you're going to teach kids young earth creationism, and that God wants them to think it's a sin to be queer, you probably shouldn't be accredited in a way that's recognized by the state. On the other hand, a lot of kids are forced into these schools and would rather be somewhere else. Or when they are able to get enough distance to think about it, they realize, wow, that was really screwed up. So how do we address this in terms of policy without punishing the kids when it's really not their fault is a tricky question.
Yeah, it's a really tricky question. We'll get maybe get onto that in later part of the interview. But how did you actually start the deconstructing process once you went to the honors program and you actually hung around secular people?
I mean, I guess that was a part of it. Now that you mention it. It was around the age of 16, though, and before I did my first stint with the Indiana State University Summer Honors Program, that I read the entire Bible through for the first time. And I really had a lot of doubts about seeing contradictions, inconsistencies, or things that I just thought were really immoral, like divinely justified genocide, you know, divinely sanctioned genocide, very disturbing. And some things I had definitely been uncomfortable with before. I think on some level, I was aware that there was a heavy degree of manipulation going on in evangelical churches and Christian schools. I mean, I can think back, and it's a pretty vivid memory, to seventh grade at Colorado Springs Christian School, and how we were all bussed off somewhere for a retreat day. I'd put that in air quotes because it wasn't much of a retreat, really, to have what I like to call fake sex head, you know.
Oh, God.
The abstinence only stuff. So I don't remember all the details about it. I believe boys and girls were separated for at least part of the day, but it was also like this big assembly where we were sitting together, and there was just a lot of fear mongering and shaming, you know, the classic stuff, like condoms almost always fail, they don't protect you from anything. And also the really weird evangelical purity culture stuff, like well, you know, you really shouldn't be dating anyone that you don't think you might marry in the future. And you definitely, if you have a boyfriend or girlfriend, don't want to do anything that you wouldn't do to somebody else's spouse. Because let's say you're dating a girl. Well, that girl is, if you don't marry that girl, then she's someone else's future spouse. And if you do something with her, you're cheating on her future spouse. Or, you know, if you end up marrying somebody else, you're cheating on your future spouse if you kiss another person. So we got the double dose of fear mongering and shaming and guilting, and then we were told to come down and take these purity pledges and find a spot to sit by ourselves and prayerfully consider whether we should sign this purity pledge, and only do it if we're really willing to commit to staying sexually pure before marriage. But you know, we honestly, people occasionally disappear from these Christian schools and like no one knows what happens. Because maybe they had alcohol at a party or something and they get expelled. Well, we didn't know if we were going to be expelled if we didn't sign the pledges. So, of course, we signed the pledges. And it felt really coercive and it felt really awkward, even to seventh grade me, where I was like, okay, I guess this is really what God wants for everybody.
Oh, I was going to say that the sex ed that you're talking about, that's a derivative of complementarianism.
Complementarianism,
I mean,
it is sort of. I mean, I think a lot of it is implicitly complementarian. They don't necessarily spell out that women are supposed to be submissive, but they do generally give the girls a harsher version of this. Girls also have stricter dress codes in Christian schools. I mean, I used to chafe at the requirements for boys, like you can't have hair on your ears or over your collar. They wouldn't let you grow long hair. But, you know, in a lot of Christian schools, girls have to wear skirts or dresses. And at least when I was in school, they would do these humiliating skirt checks sometimes in front of the whole class. Like they would make a girl kneel to make sure that her skirt touched the floor.
That's so disturbing.
Yeah, and with the sex ed stuff, I mean, I remember hearing things that, like, you know, if you take a piece of duct tape and you stick it on something and then you unstick it and you stick it and you unstick it, eventually it stops being sticky. Or I think I saw that illustration once with like two like half hearts that were Velcroed, and like you stick them together and you stick them apart. And what they're trying to say there is that sex is meant to create a special bond between people, and if you have a lot of sex, it will stop working that way. I was reading Linda K. Klein's book Pure on purity culture.
I've been wanting to read that.
Yeah, it's good. She says that's the only illustration that she's heard both boys and girls experience. But the girls would get the things like, if you have sex, you're like a chewed up piece of gum. Or you're like a rose that lost its petals. So,
oh my God.
So I internalized this purity culture stuff, you know, also in the way that I absolutely thought it applied to me, and like I would be damaged goods and it would be horrible if I had sex before marriage. But apparently most boys do not. Apparently they're like, you know, because of the way that's emphasized so much for the girls, they get the lion's share of this shame. But certainly it does really mess with boys' heads too, and there should be some more research done on how it affects boys. But, you know, by and large, this kind of purity culture is patriarchal, and it's sort of an inflection of rape culture. And you do see girls getting blamed for being assaulted and raped in evangelical environments. It happens all the time that they're even sometimes made to, in the more fundamentalist environments, made to go before congregations and repent, or at least before pastors, for their part in causing their own assault.
Yeah. Circling back to what you were saying about used goods and some of the things that they learn in sex ed is I went down a YouTube rabbit hole of evangelical Christianity, and I came across this one video. It reminded me of Reefer Madness, and it was talking about to girls and boys actually too, about the women, girls and women's responsibility to dress modestly because guys can't turn off their sex drive. And it was that was wow. Did you experience that, or did you hear about that as well when you were in school? Or
yeah, that's a very typical message in evangelical environments. Sometimes even in sermons, you hear over and over these gender stereotypes. And you know, men are supposed to be warriors or something, and also men are like very visually oriented and they just can't control their sex drive, and women can cause them to stumble, so everyone dress modestly. And it's always about, you know, it's men just can't control themselves. Like it's ridiculous, but yeah, it's very common in evangelical subculture. So yeah, it does perpetuate rape culture, even though they're also telling the boys, don't cheat on your future spouse, don't have sex until you get married. And well, here's another big problem with all of this is just in all of it, there's absolutely no concept of consent.
Yeah.
You know, so everything that is sin just falls into the category of sin. So like, if you rape someone, if you molest a child, or if you just have sex outside of marriage, well, hey, it's all just sin. Or if you have gay sex, you know, well, it's all just
sin. It's all sin. What we're kind of hinting at here, and we're not saying these are biblical gender roles. If you can play clip number three for me, Chris, if you can listen to this, this is Frank Sontag from KKLA in Los Angeles.
There is an attempted indoctrination going on with the youth. That's clear. With now it's about gender neutrality, gender equality, and somehow your 4 or 5 year old, well, they just have to be brought into this world of love where little Bobby thinks he's a girl this morning and we have to go along with it. And I don't want to sound insensitive, but
yeah,
I don't want to sound insensitive, but
yeah.
But if that were my boy, yeah, I'd smack him with a 2x4.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's I listened to that as kind of a sadomasochist practice. And that's why trans people are coming up against like trans bathroom bills, is the heavy indoctrination within Christian schools. You have what's known as biblical gender roles, and that part of that is complementarianism. And that leaves little space for anything else.
Yeah, I like that he said that we're trying to indoctrinate children in things like be yourself and we should all just be nice to each other. But of course, you know, they're always projecting, right? Because
yeah,
they actually do indoctrinate children into this hardline authoritarian ideology, and if you don't conform, there are many serious consequences. And corporal punishment is frequently used in evangelical subculture and celebrated both at home and at school. I think there are still many Christian schools that use the paddle.
And that's why you started the hashtag Expose Christian Schools, was because Karen Pence, the second lady of the country, she's actually teaching a canvas painting at one of these schools.
Yeah, so all those kids can grow up to be the next Thomas Kincaid.
Oh, Lord.
I mean, evangelicals have terrible taste in art. I'm just putting that out there.
I do like George W. Bush. Like, his paintings are extremely amazing. And the guy that paints the Trump stuff, that's, like, I love really, like, lowbrow, crappy art, and I want to plaster that everywhere. But go ahead.
They are kind of, those things are sort of special. and I'm using that word with all its evangelical connotations. Well, sometimes special is good in evangelical culture, just like, and sometimes it's bad. Just like sometimes bless your heart is an insult, mm-hmm. and sometimes it's an expression of empathy. But anyway, right. So there was, of course, a lot of predictable and very legitimate concern and anger from liberals and people on the left over Karen Pence teaching in a school that sticks to this complementarian patriarchal ideology and is explicitly anti-LGBTQ. And where I came on the scene with that was not so much in the initial criticism, but then I saw how this petulant reaction against the criticism from Mike Pence himself, where he actually tweeted, criticism of Christian education in America must stop. And David French wrote this like ridiculous piece in National Review about how horribly persecuted their Christianity is being attacked. I was like, oh, you think you're being attacked? You haven't seen anything yet, boys.
Yeah.
So that's when I created Exposed Christian Schools. In response to their pushback against just the mildest, most legitimate, perfectly legitimate criticism, I was like, all right, we're going to talk about what actually happens in Christian schools, and then we'll see how people feel. So it was kind of a visceral reaction in the moment when I created it on January 18th, and I did also think it would be mostly a discussion about evangelical schools, evangelical and fundamentalists, because they tend to be the ones that call themselves Christian schools or Christian academies, unlike Catholic schools and mainline schools, which might call themselves like Episcopal Academy or Jesuit Academy. And also, those schools vary in quality and ideology in ways that evangelical schools just don't. Evangelical schools are all right-wing indoctrination machines. It's just a matter of degree. So anyway, I threw the hashtag out there. It wasn't a coordinated, pre-planned effort. But once I put that first tweet out there, where I also added Mike Pence and David French to throw it in their faces, I did then send it around to some people, ask for retweets, and ask them to tweet so that hopefully we could get this going. And well, it really got going way beyond anything that I ever could have expected. It got into the top trends. Maybe because we started it like late Friday afternoon or early evening, that would seem like a bad time to try to start something. But yeah. Again, I was just doing a visceral reaction in the moment. But I think that it made it, since it did start to take off, it probably required fewer tweets to start to get into Twitter's top trends. And so then more and more people noticed, and it snowballed, and the trolls also noticed, and they started planning counter talking points on 4chan because they wanted to fight back against this. And so they were floating on 4chan like, hey, let's all ask them, why don't they criticize Islam? Let's do exposed Muslim schools. Let's do exposed public schools. And then all these talking points appeared on Twitter and appeared in some of the right-wing media as well. Right-wing media started to freak out about this. It was on Fox and Friends. and also on January 19th, that video broke with those Covington Catholic boys in their MAGA hats, you know? So then it blew up some more. Eventually there were over 200,000 tweets. I haven't been able to track it exactly, but I was using just like the free online version of Trends Maps for a while, where it would show you how many tweets of a certain hashtag there were in the last 24-hour period. And when I was looking at that, it peaked at 170,000 in a 24-hour period. Wow. Which is remarkable. But the whole thing with the Covington Catholic School kind of confused the issue and muddied the waters a bit, I think, because many people then started thinking that's where it started and that it was targeting Catholic schools. And I think it's perfectly valid to broaden the conversation and bring Catholic schools in, but it was targeted at evangelical schools. And Catholic schools, just we have to recognize that they're not all the same. Some of them really teach social justice, downplay the magisterium's teachings on sex and gender, you know, and others of them are pretty hardline fundamentalists too. Obviously, Covington Catholic is a terrible place, but the pushback in the right-wing media sphere, which is just like crazy, it's just everywhere. It's Town Hall, Daily Caller, Daily Wire, it's on Matt Walsh's podcast. I mean, PJ Media. It's just all over. They were so mad about this hashtag. Mostly they don't credit it to me, or they say I claimed to create it because they're trying to insinuate that it actually is a conspiracy that was pre-planned. And if you look at tweets from right-wingers, some of them even suggest that somehow we planned it as a way to set up the Covington Catholic boys because we knew they were going to taunt a Native American. Like, what? But it wasn't about Covington Catholic, but that brought Catholic schools into the like basically every right wing you can imagine is so mad at those Christian schools.
Those Christian schools have unearthed a lot of disturbing behaviors and events that have happened under the guise of Christian education, including slave days and sexual abuse.
I didn't even know about slave days.
Explain slave day, because that was just, I couldn't believe that one.
Yeah, that one woman's tweet, she went to Christian school in Minnesota. It really blew up, where she talks about how the junior class was auctioned off every year at an imitation slave auction, where they would have to be slaves for a day to whoever bought them. And the faculty member who emceed the auction carried a whip. So this is exactly subtle.
Wow.
Overtones, you know.
It was like a fundraiser, right? It was just an innocent fundraiser. Yeah.
I think maybe she said for their prom, and I was like, "Whoa, you had a prom, but yeah. You also had slave day." most Christian schools, I think, do not have proms because the dancing thing is a no-no. At least, you know, not on school grounds, not with school sponsorship or in any official way. So we had the Christmas banquet and the junior senior banquet at my school. It was like a nice catered meal with suitably Christian entertainment. We had a Christian ventriloquist one time.
What makes one a Christian ventriloquist? I don't.
You have particular dummies that speak to evangelical themes, and you make a lot about evangelical themes, so some of it's like inside kind of humor. And then, you know, one of his dummies is an old lady named Tilly, like an old church lady, and he actually has her sing softly and tenderly Jesus is calling. So like everything has to be Christian to evangelicals because it's such a totalitarian way of approaching faith. You know, if it's not somehow suffusing every aspect of your life, you're doing it wrong and Jesus might be mad at you. But yeah, so the slave day thing, I had never heard of that. And then there were like, I think, thousands of replies in that thread because it was so shocking to people. But it turns out that a lot of public schools in the South have done that as well.
I had no idea, but
many Christian schools throughout the country apparently did or do the slave day thing. It seems like maybe in the 90s is when a lot of them got rid of it or named it Servant Day instead because... Well, I guess that sounds better.
That sounds a lot better. So, we were talking earlier, and my guess if you're just joining us right now is Chris Stroop. He has a blog site called Not Your Mission Field, and he's done writings in Playboy. And what are some of the other places that your work has appeared?
Foreign Policy, Religion Dispatches, including both on the old Religion Dispatches site and on the new one that's under rewire.news.
Okay.
Chronicle of Higher Education, Moscow Times, a lot of places.
Okay, cool. So, like, we've talked about a lot about Christian schools. There is still freedom of religion in this country, and then Christian schools still accommodate themselves to have some kind of authority that your degree means something. Where is the line in regulation to make sure that schools aren't indoctrination centers and they actually do learn like actual facts? Because this is a problem, right? So a lot of the hashtag in exposed Christian schools was like, oh, now I've got to like catch up on remedial biology because I never learned about that in Christian school, high school science at all. That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or I got to check if my history is right, because either nobody taught us about Nelson Mandela or they taught us that Nelson Mandela was a bad guy and a horrible communist.
Yeah.
that's definitely a lot of it. And it is a problem because often they do get to be considered properly accredited. They're allowed to offer AP classes and that sort of thing. But in my AP biology class, the teacher would sometimes, it had two periods because you have one for the lab, you know, and the teacher would sometimes waste almost the entire first period on this rambling devotional that he would call a thought.
Oh, God.
And he was like a kind of apocalyptic mystic, and particularly in the fall, he would be very apocalyptic, and he would say things like, "And so I had this dream, and I was before the white throne of judgment, and there was Jesus separating the sheep from the goats, and I was so nervous because I didn't know if any of my students would be among the goats, and so I was running back and forth trying to see if any of my students were among the goats, and I was so relieved that they weren't." And he would go on and on in this way. And he would also tell us things like, you know, look how much sin is increasing right now, because look how much our society has started being nice to gay people, and that's so sinful. And in Matthew it says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the time of the coming of the Son of Man. So I think this is the year of Noah. And did you hear they're genetically engineering red heifers to be sacrificed on the Temple Mount? And he would always bring this around to like his conclusion that Christ is probably coming back this fall around Yom Kippur.
Oh. Yom Kippur.
That's our science teacher.
Yeah, wow.
And then he refused to teach us the evolution chapters in AP Biology. So he would also show us videos of young Earth creationism and flood geology. So he was giving us all these alternative facts, but it was a compliant AP Biology course on paper. We had the standard secular college textbook. And then he literally told us, "I'm not going to teach you the evolution chapters, but you should go read them on your own and regurgitate them for the exam." So basically he was saying, lie for Jesus, which is classic hashtag how to evangelical.
Yeah, if you were growing up in these times, would you have made a field trip to Ken Ham's The Ark Experience? Because that's a current ongoing lawsuit right now, is the Freedom From Religion Foundation is saying, hey, this isn't quite anything that you need to know about, because it is, it's a theology-based story, and we're running a secular school, so you really shouldn't be taking public-funded, you know, field trips to these places.
Mm-hmm. Oh, are there public school field trips to the Ark Encounter?
Yeah, that's a current ongoing lawsuit, so I just was wondering.
Whoa.
I
didn't know about that. I mean, I knew about the disputes. Maybe these are settled by now over the tax incentives that they got, because they are not compliant with non-discrimination laws, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, not like probably most self-accepting queer people would want to work there.
No.
But if you did go apply for a job and they knew what you believed and who you were, you would be refused. They shouldn't be allowed to get tax incentives to build that kind of business either. But I don't know what happened with that. I hadn't heard about the field trip thing. I'll have to look that up. I don't know. I don't think we really took field trips for our high school science classes. We did. All the juniors and seniors each year would be sent to these this local Indianapolis kind of a tea party before the Tea Party convention. It was an organization called Citizens Concerned for the Constitution. It has since been rebranded Advance America, and it bills itself as Indiana's most pro-family, pro-homeschooling, pro-Christian schools organization. So they would send us there, and we would hear these radical right-wing speeches. It's definitely not neutral civics lessons. And, you know, get more of the all, oh, we have to stop abortion, we have to stop the baby killers, we have to keep queer people from getting rights. And then we would get voter guides, and we would actually spend school time stuffing them into envelopes and mailing them out so people would know to make sure to vote for the candidates approved by Citizens Concerned for the Constitution.
Yeah, yeah. In your piece about the Karen Pence teaching at the school, the Christian school, you bring up the authoritarianism within these schools. Can you go talk a little about that?
Yeah, well, evangelical subculture is simply authoritarian through and through. It's evangelicals are all about control and obedience. They emphasize obedience as a virtue. They don't emphasize or they even look down upon things like self-expression, particularly in any way that differentiates you from the community. Absolute conformity on everything is expected. And they use corporal punishment, both at home and in school. The worst that I got growing up was sometimes we were spanked with a wooden spoon. Some people get much worse than the wooden spoon.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're basically told that you have to do that. That's the only proper way to raise children. There are evangelicals and fundamentalists who even go so far as to argue that you need to ignore babies when they cry so they learn not to just ask for attention. You need to spank infants because they already have their sinful nature in them, and you have to start putting them in their place and working that out of them. They talk a lot about the need to break children's wills so that they learn to obey. So yeah, this is a very authoritarian subculture, which is why it's not at all surprising that they support Donald Trump. They would much rather keep power and control than keep democracy. They don't give a rat's ass about democracy. They want power.
Yeah. When we first talked about scheduling this interview, we were going to talk about just Expose Christian Skulls, the hashtag. But because life under the Trump administration moves faster than, Ferris Bueller on his day off, we also now have Project Blitz, and the president actually endorsed the Biblical Literacy Act, which has passed in several states. How close are we getting to Christian dominionism in some parts of the country?
They are frighteningly close, in my view. Certainly in parts of the country now, it's already, say, for example, nearly impossible to get an abortion and dangerous to be openly, visibly queer. And I think that's only going to get worse. I mean, they got the Supreme Court. I think there's a real chance that Roe will be overturned, and Obergefell could also be overturned. So we may be going back to a time where certain civil rights are not recognized, and of course trans rights and gay rights are not nearly universally what they should be across the United States anyway. There's quite a patchwork of protections in different states and different municipalities. But if you want to see the religious rights authoritarian nature, you know, they often love the states' rights argument when it's convenient. But look what they did in North Carolina when Charlotte passed a trans protection ordinance and allowed access to bathrooms that are appropriate for a person's gender identity. The state house in North Carolina overruled Charlotte, so they don't really care about devolving power to the local level. They just care about exerting as much power as they can. They have a deep-seated need to be in control, and they're motivated by fear.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Project Blitz is, there's a whole handbook of strategy that was put out by the Congressional Prayer Caucus. It provides model legislation for state legislatures for various kinds of state initiatives, starting with the relatively symbolic level. This is where we're seeing all these bills popping up across the country, in some cases passing, to require the posting of our inane, stupid Cold War era national motto, "In God We Trust," in every public school. So that passed in Florida, for example. And I think some other states as well, but I'd have to double check off the top of my head exactly where. Anyway, they think, you know, this is the one that's going to be relatively easy to get through, and then you move on to things that will be a harder sell, but you soften the public up. And if you get any pushback, what you do is you call it anti-Christian bigotry. And that's exactly what the right-wing response to Expose Christian Skulls has been as well, and that's not coincidental. They've circled the wagons and they've said, this is a vicious attack on Christianity, which it isn't at all. Because, you know, there are a lot of queer Christians, there are a lot of straight Christians who believe in equal rights, who support abortion rights, who support same-sex marriage. So when they claim that this is an attack on Christianity, they're also claiming to represent the only true Christianity as this very narrow and bigoted one.
Yeah, and then they'll dismiss anything else as liberal theology, and that just is totally off the reservation.
Yeah.
where do you think this is, like, so you also started the hashtag empty the pews, and according to demographic data, the pews have been emptying. So do you think they're going to install their theocracy before, like, the people of our generation have completely emptied the pews? And so they're going to, I mean, like, there's a kind of a teeter-totter going on right now in that regard.
Yes. Yeah. But I would definitely caution against assuming that we're out of the woods, because again, these are people who have no scruples about imposing minority authoritarian rule and destroying democracy. And they're trying to do that now under Trump to the extent that they can. They're undermining our institutions and our constitution. So if we don't find some way electorally to take power back, they can do immense damage, and it's impossible to predict for how long, despite the fact that the country is cheeringly becoming much less religious, and young people are much less religious because the most visible religion in America is this horrible kind that wants to take absolute control over everybody and force people to conform to this cis heteropatriarchal norm, which to many people is absolutely traumatizing and psychologically damaging. It's encouraging that young people are leaving the church, but if we don't manage to do something about the Electoral College problem, dismantle voter suppression, get young people and minorities out to vote, there are no guarantees here that we win the policy battles in the decades ahead.
Yeah. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is the Heather McCoy Show. My guest is Christopher Stroop. He's on Twitter, and he has not your mission field as a blog post. We're gonna be right back. We're gonna be taking your calls. I don't have the number memorized from the top of your head, but you probably have it on speed dial already. And thanks for listening to KBOO this morning.
Try.
The Heather McCoy Show.
And welcome back to The Heather McCoy Show. Joining me is Chris Stoop. He is he's an author and writer, and he blogs at Not Your Mission Field. You can find him on Twitter as well. What's your Twitter handle, Chris?
It's at @C_Stroop.
Okay, cool. The number is 503-231-8187 if you want to get in your last-minute questions. The interview portion went a little bit longer than I had thought it would go, so we wanted to get more listener calls in, but do call in. It's 503-231-8187 if you want to contribute to the conversation this morning. Some of the other things... When we were talking about the hashtag expose Christian schools, you were saying that they do have some pushback. And so what would the reaction be? Will they have some weird acronym to conference when they were starting to get pushback when the hashtag Church 2 was started by Emily Joy and Hannah Panache? Or are they just going to kind of whistle past the graveyard on this one?
Well, you know, some people have been floating exposed public schools. I think Matt Walsh did a whole podcast episode for exposed public schools.
Wow.
And people have tried exposed Islamic schools, exposed Muslim schools, exposed Jewish schools, but none of that is really sticking to any extent. It's obviously bad faith whataboutism. And to the extent that you can make a case that our public schools are bad, it's because of these same people who have been deliberately depriving them of funds so they can have a nice self-fulfilling prophecy, because they want to be able to control kids. They don't want kids to get a good education that won't consist of indoctrination into their ideology.
Yeah. And then some that can't afford to do the Christian schools because sometimes the tuition is cost prohibitive. They do homeschooling. A story was recently discovered that the homeschooling movement there's like a lobbying group called the Homeschool Legal Association. It's HSLDA. And since you graduated from Stanford with a Russian PhD in Russian modern history, what do you make of the revelations that the Russians have been funding this organization since 1983?
Well, I wouldn't say that they've been funding them, or they're certainly not their primary funders.
Okay.
But they have had this kind of close relationship, and Russia has paid for some conferences and things like that. Yeah, I mean, that doesn't surprise me at all. Particularly, well, when things opened up a little more in the 80s, there were attempts by conservative Christians to get more access behind the Iron Curtain. And then when the Soviet Union fell apart in 1991, there was just this huge influx, and the most radical far right wing ministries, have a presence there. But what's happened since that time is that Russia has become, you know, not just kind of a recipient of our exported culture wars, but has become a partner and a player and an exporter of its own culture wars as well. Because now under Putin, and especially since his third term, Russia's legitimating ideology is one of traditional values, right? So a lot of right-wingers look to Russia as a kind of moral standard bearer in the world today, much as in Soviet times there were left-wing fellow travelers. We're in an era now of largely right-wing fellow travelers.
Yeah, because Putin's third term, the Orthodox Russian Church has a lot of, just like he cuddles up to them, just like the Trump administration is basically conning the religious right. Is that a fair assessment? Or?
Well, they do in both cases have a close relationship, but I wouldn't say that Trump's conning the religious right. He is, I think, more being used by them than he's using them, because
really?
He's pursuing their agenda far more vigorously and effectively than any previous president. Even George W. Bush was not going to move our embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem on the basis of rapture prophecy.
Yeah.
Trump did it. And Trump keeps on pushing any kind of discriminatory initiatives that he can against transgender people, for example, the trans military ban. All of the anti-trans stuff in the Trump administration is being whispered into his ear by people like Tony Perkins, who heads the Family Research Council and SPLC-designated hate group. So yeah, no, the Christian right's getting everything they want out of this. Trump gives unprecedented access to conservative, mostly white evangelicals. He gives them a crazy high level of access to him as president. And then also, in a way that is unlike previous presidents, he doesn't give anything close to equal access to religious leaders of other traditions. He basically cuts them out. So yeah, his relationship to white evangelicals and radical Catholics, far-right Catholics, does resemble Putin's relationship to the Russian Orthodox Church.
Yeah, some of the people that have gotten close to Trump, like Tony Perkins from the Family Research Council, and Focus on the Family. I forget who heads up now that James Dobson has been kicked out.
Jim Daly. Yeah.
Jim Daly. Mm. Yeah. Basically, like the Southern Poverty Law Center, and rightfully so, labels these groups as hate groups because they are so anti-LGBT. But then they're like, we're just following our religious beliefs, and they're like the Southern Poverty Law Center at one point, like that was like a very neutral source to go to on you know, for looking at hate crimes or like for hate groups. They even call out, you know, they also call out like minority groups that have hate groups. I think there's like a black Muslim group that has like a hateful ideology that they put on their hate map as well. But then like now the Southern Poverty Law Center is just some, you know, radical organization like the ACLU, and then they're trying to get the mainstream press not to cite them. And that's scary.
Yeah, no, I think they're still very solid. I still greatly respect the Southern Poverty Law Center. And unsurprisingly, the vast majority of hate groups that they list are white, and they're like radical religious right.
Yeah.
And or alt-right, neo-Nazi, racist, quote-unquote patriot, militia, these kinds of groups.
Yeah. Yeah, and so like it seems like they're kind of working the refs in the same way that we were talking, where like you know, like anything that you say against us is just anti-Christian bigotry, and yeah,
that's the card that they like to play, and it's a classic, it's a classic abuser card. I mean, what they do is deny, deflect, and try to reverse the role of victim and perpetrator. You know, if they can make themselves into the victim, then they generate sympathy, and they shut off criticism. So. That's certainly what all the right-wing pushback to expose Christian schools also looks like.
Yeah.
They're the victims here. We should feel so sorry for them.
What do you think some of the challenges in the new year of 2019 are going to be? Everything just happens extremely quickly right now. It might be just the speed of life is sped up by the internet, or it might be just the times that we live in. What are some of the ways that people can like fight back against like you know, Christian fascists, in other words?
Yeah, I think when it comes to the Christian right, those of us who survived it and left it have very important insights. And
yeah.
Often we have been kind of dismissed, or voices crying in the wilderness, if you will. There are some memoirs out there, but you know, any one person's experience can be written off as, well, that's fringe, particularly when newspapers have generally been doing, our major newspapers have been doing, a poor job of covering evangelicals, where either they write about themselves or they just write about them in a very softball way. In so many articles about evangelicals, only evangelicals are quoted. So one thing that the ex-evangelical movement has been trying to do has been to get ourselves recognized by speaking out collectively in a way that can't be ignored, and hashtags help with that, as stakeholders in national discussions of evangelicalism, in a way that we now see, if you want to say something about Scientology, it's not legitimate to exclude perspectives of former Scientologists who are talking about the abuse, right?
Yeah.
So the same thing should be true when you're covering evangelicalism. Evangelicals have been very savvy and smooth. They've got this whole lobbying infrastructure that we discussed a little, like the Family Research Council and many other organizations, Liberty Council. They've got deep pockets. They've cultivated ties to journalists, and they've played the PR game very well, so that they generally get good press, and they're looked at as relatively benign and playing and participating in democracy in good faith, but they're not. So I think one thing that people can do is amplify the voices of ex-evangelicals, or demand that journalists include critical perspectives when they're covering evangelicals. write your own letters to the editor, op-eds. If you have the means, you know, you can contribute maybe to evangelical Patreons for the kinds of projects that we do where we're trying to raise awareness and have important conversations,
yeah,
things like that.
Awesome. My guest this hour has been Chris Stoop. He's the author, academic. He can find it at his writings at Not My Mission Field. That's the kind of the aggregate site he writes for, what was it, Foreign Policy and Playboy and various publications.
And a number of others, yeah, yeah, Religion Dispatches. Number... And yeah, notyourmissionfield.com or chrisstoop.com.
Awesome.
They both go to my website. The blog's called Not Your Mission Field.
Meet me on the mountain.
KBOO wants you to meet us where the music's at.
You can see awesome live bands like Fruition.
That's right. KBOO wants to send you to a concert this summer.
Just enter the KBOO Summer Music Raffle, where three lucky winners will choose an order from three awesome events.
You could win 2 3-day passes to the Northwest String Summit, July 19th to the 21st.
A pair of Sunday tickets to Pickathon, August 4th.
A pair of tickets to Lord Huron and Shaky Graves at the Oregon Zoo, August 12th.
Tickets are just $5, and if you buy 4, you get an extra raffle chance for free.
Enter at kboo.fm/give, or you can buy tickets in person at Music Millennium or Grendel's Coffee.
Deadline to enter is July 7th. See kboo.fm/summermusicraffle for full rules and details.
Enter now for your chance to win.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 11 o'clock. Coming up next on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews author Ted Chiang about his new book of science fiction stories titled Exhalation. Then, at 11:30, Black Book Talk talks to Lua Ubunufu, the author of Cage the Locked, My Personal Experience with Circumstantial Depression. Then, from noon to 10 p.m., it's our live broadcast from the Waterfront Blues Festival. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Portland Saturday Market. 46 years of American-made arts and crafts, freshly prepared international foods, local artisans, and local music in downtown Portland. Open every Saturday and Sunday in Waterfront Park now through Christmas Eve. Event schedule, vendor information, and more is available at PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the writer Ted Chiang. Chiang graduated from Brown University with a degree in computer science and is a graduate of the Clarion Writers Workshop, the premier workshop for writers of science fiction and fantasy.